This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Auto insurance can all seem the same until it comes time to use it. So don't get stuck paying more for less coverage. Switch to USAA Auto Insurance and you could start saving money in no time. Get a quote today. Restrictions apply. USAA.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. If you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. You also get ad-free versions of every episode of the podcast. Right now, you can find a bonus episode about what we watched during our month-long hiatus with more episodes to come. You can find it all at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Genevieve Kosky
and Scott Tobias.
Tasha Robinson could not be with us this week due to food poisoning after eating a bad batch of Limbas. Sorry. I hope you feel better soon. Joining us instead is our returning guest, Roxana Haddadi. Roxana, welcome back and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're talking about a big chunk of J.R.R. Tolkien-inspired entertainment this week. Before we do, I was wondering where everyone else first encountered Tolkien. What was your Tolkien entry point?
For me, it was The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. Like The Hobbit was incredible. That was a book I read when I was a kid, and I loved flipping back and forth to the map. Like the map was so exciting to kind of just see where the journey was going. Then I tried to read Lord of the Rings proper, and I couldn't do it. It was too dense for little me. But The Hobbit was a key experience for me as a young reader.
Yeah, if I had to venture a guess, I'd say that all of us probably encountered The Hobbit as younger folk, and then where we went afterwards may have diverged, or maybe not. Roxana?
Yeah, Genevieve, you would be incorrect.
Oh, please tell me more.
I think I saw the Bakshi Lord of the Rings first.
Ah.
I have some memory of watching that. I think I watched that like maybe in fourth or fifth grade with my brother, who is 3 years older than me. So I think we watched it together, and then I saw Jackson's movies, and then I read the Lord of the Rings books. And then in like college, I read The Hobbit as like a little treat. I like went entirely backward. But yeah, it was a good time.
I love that though. And now you're like a dedicated, devoted fan, right? So maybe.
Yeah, like maybe too much. Although yes and no, right? Because like to be like a super dedicated fan, you have to do what we're doing now, which is talk about like the appendices and the Silmarillion and like all the gathered texts. I would say I'm like a passionate movie defender, interested TV watcher, and, you know, sometimes I audible it up. Sometimes I listen to the audiobooks. Let's get wild with it.
Do they sing the songs on the audiobooks?
They do. Okay. No. Okay. Andy Serkis like sings all the songs. It's a good time.
This is sounding appealing. Yeah, I think like you, I have this like hazy memory of watching part of the Bakshi movie on cable when I was like sick and like falling asleep, mm-hmm. and not really knowing what was going on. But yeah, I read The Hobbit, and then I read Lord of the Rings, and this is like sixth grade. I was really was my big Tolkien.
How precocious.
Phase.
I'll tell you
that. Well, I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
Actually, it cuts to the chase pretty well. They're the beginning.
Yeah.
It takes care of the exposition a lot faster than the Peter Jackson, but I don't want to get that result.
Yeah. All right. Well, we should probably actually just like get into the Tolkien selection we are wanting to talk about today. Genevieve, can you share that information with us?
Sure. As already teased, Prime Video recently launched one of the most ambitious series of the streaming era with a title whose length suggested scope, The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Set in what Tolkien called the Second Age of Middle-earth, it takes place thousands of years before the events of The Lord of the Rings and concerns the forging of the troublesome rings at the center of his best-known work. After watching a few episodes, we thought it would be illuminating to pair it with the 2001 film The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, the first of three Lord of the Rings adaptations directed by Peter Jackson.
Expect plenty of elves, dwarves, hobbits, and Harfoots in both episodes, but we'll begin with what, in the grand scheme of Tolkien's creation, was the beginning of the end of Middle-earth's history, then leap back in time to the new TV series. Yes, that's a little confusing. We'll explain it all after the break.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The weapon of the enemy is a gift. Let us use it against him.
You cannot wield it.
None of us can.
The ring must be destroyed.
It was made in the fires of Mount Doom. Only there can it be unmade.
I know what I must do, but I'm afraid to do it.
One does not simply walk into Mordor.
There is no other way.
Something down there. Precious.
The Lord of the Rings was always a story too big to be contained in one novel, even before J.R.R. Tolkien's publishers insisted he break up his fantasy epic into three separate books when it was published in 1954. A sequel to his popular 1937 novel, The Hobbit, which concerned the adventures of Bilbo Baggins, some dwarves, a dragon, and a magic ring, The Lord of the Rings represented just a sliver of the history of Middle-earth. The rest was in Tolkien's head and his notebooks and in the pieces he'd written for what would eventually be compiled posthumously as The Silmarillion, a sweeping history of Middle-earth from its creation through the end of its Third Age. The Lord of the Rings was bigger than a novel in other ways, too. It featured maps and illustrations that lent an added reality to Middle-earth. It inspired songs performed by everyone from Led Zeppelin to Leonard Nimoy. It prompted the counterculture fans who latched onto the book in the 1960s to make buttons and graffiti reading, spoiler warning, Frodo lives. And if it didn't invent the high fantasy genre, it came to define it. The Lord of the Rings also largely defied attempts to adapt it into a movie, or at least a live-action movie. We don't really have the time or energy to talk that much about Ralph Bakshi's 1978 film or the Rankin-Bass TV movies. Not only would a film version have to compete with the imaginations of Tolkien's readers, it would have to find a way to create the sweeping world of Middle-earth and all of its inhabitants. It would need a creator who got Tolkien's vision and had the visual and technological wizardry to bring that vision to the screen. Enter Peter Jackson, or more specifically, enter Jackson and a creative team that included his longtime writing partner Fran Walsh and co-writer Philippa Boyens, and the technicians at Weta Workshop. The team approached the project with a combination of respect for Tolkien's story and his irony-free approach to storytelling, old-fashioned camera trickery and movie magic, and cutting-edge digital effects capable of bringing fantastic creatures to life and simulating the clashes of great armies. A lot could have gone wrong, but watching the resulting films, it's hard not to marvel with all that went right. That's evident in the earliest scenes of The Fellowship of the Ring. The wizard Gandalf, played by Ian McKellen, arrives in a shire that feels as quaint and lived in as the place described by Tolkien. And it's just as evident in The Fellowship of the Ring's final moments, when the film has taken the once lighthearted hero Frodo Baggins and his companions to darker terrain, both literally and figuratively. Frodo ends the film burdened with a horrible weight, given no less a task than saving the world from eternal darkness. In between, Fellowship faithfully squeezes as much of Tolkien's narrative into the film as a digestible running time will allow, spare a moment of pity for poor Tom Bombadil, while bringing many of his fantastic creations to life. But it's also respectful of the themes driving Tolkien's work. a sense of how temptation can undo even those with the best intentions, and that doing good means waging a constant battle with the temptation and forces of corruption. And maybe that's the real secret to adapting Tolkien, beyond the relatively simple task of creating a believable fantasy world. Realizing that for its creator, Middle-earth wasn't all that far off a place after all, but it's a place filled with familiar characters, even if they sometimes had pointy ears and hairy feet.
I wish the ring had never come to me. I wish none of this had happened.
So do all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us. There are other forces at work in this world, Frodo, besides the will of evil. Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you also were meant to have it. And that is an encouraging thought.
I've offered a brief synopsis of my take on this film, why this film works and its sequels work as well. What's yours, or am I wrong? Does anyone not like this movie?
Who would? Who could not like it? Like, please, like, get out of my life. Like, I want nothing to do with you ever again.
Yeah, I hadn't revisited Fellowship in probably at least 15, maybe closer to 20 years. So I was, like, going into this rewatch thinking,
Genevieve.
I know, yeah, we don't need to go into it, but so I was kind of afraid that I would come into this rewatch and have this isn't as good as I remember. Oh, this is kind of cornier than I remembered. Nope, none of that. It like held up phenomenally. I'm like, why am I not rewatching this movie every year? Like my husband is always bugging me to do, and I always say no.
It's phenomenal. It really is. I unfortunately have been around long enough to where I was a critic at the time. I appreciated this film at the time for sure. Like everybody else, it was an acclaimed film and it was also a hit. But I feel like when you watch it now and consider where franchises are, where blockbusters are, where effects are, where acting in these types of movies, like where the writing, like, you know, the level of expressiveness, like this is so much better than all of that stuff. Like it is so, it's in this class above, and it's exhilarating. It's exhilarating.
The way humor you talking about it in relation to modern fantasies, like I was so taken with how humor is integrated into this film, and it doesn't have that feeling of like someone came in and wrote some jokes to punch it up, you know, like it felt very organic and in the performances and to a certain extent in the source material.
No, I mean, it's spirited. It's a real sincere adventure. And when it is funny, it is, you know, it does feel organic. It doesn't feel jokey. It doesn't feel like it's been punched up in a writer's room. And I just, you know, I feel like the mix of practical and digital effects is, again, there's nothing that good now. Not even close. And again, you know, it's a tragedy, really. That I mean, like, we're supposed to have we're supposed to be moving forward on all of this stuff, and it feels like we're taking a big step back on every single aspect of what makes this film really good. So, you know, I loved seeing it again, and I'm ready to charge forward into into the Two Towers. And
I definitely had that same urge, like, oh, now I need to watch the next two movies, but I can't do it until after this discussion because I will get confused.
I think in terms of the effects, I think to their credit, I think the Star Wars sequels, especially Force Awakens, really did try to return to this mix of practical and digital with some success. But you're right, the people and it's weird too, because, like, you know, we've seen these digital armies clashing on fields of battle so many times since then, but it just looks better here. Maybe it's just a matter of just, like, you know, the first kind of made the deepest impression. I don't know. But to your other point you were making, you know, I think there was like, this is really good, but I think it took until the Two Towers, like, oh, wait, they really know what they're doing. This is really going to be, they're just really seeing this through as the best way possible.
Let me tell you why the digital effects are better.
Okay.
Because they're aestheticized. You know what I mean? It's not just a bunch of things clashing against each other. It's like, it's thought through in a very graphically pleasing way. And so it really doesn't matter you know, when you, you know, one of the things, one of the problems with these kind of big battles is that everything feels fairly weightless in a lot of these movies. Again, I feel like I'm subtweeting Marvel with all this stuff, but here it's like you remember a lot of the images. You remember, you know, because Peter Jackson has sort of thought them through, and you think about an image like, you know, in this where the floodwaters are sort of raised and they become these you know, stallions or whatever that are sort of charging across the water. That's a digital effect, but it's also aestheticized in a very striking way. I mean, that's such a key point, and I'm probably going to bring it up a million times, but like, this is an expressive film. This is a personal film. I mean, and you don't, that's what you want and so rarely get on movies of such a big scale, because there's so much at stake and there's so many cooks in the kitchen. But like, this feels homemade in a way that early Peter Jackson films feel, the ones that cost no money, you know, Meet the Feebles and Bad Taste and Dead Alive. I mean, this is somebody who has thought everything through, and it just makes all the difference in the world.
There's much less Muppet sex and murder in this one than in
Meet the Feebles. Much less, unless you watch all the way to the end credits and then it's just like hidden in there. I also think the thing too is that, like, I feel like Peter Jackson knew that people were here for this story, so we're not wasting time with like gigantic action sequences where you can't see 60% of what's happening, right? Like, action sequences exist. There is like the cave troll, and there is of course like all of the precursor where we see Isildur taking the ring. Like, all of that stuff is there, but we're not spending so much time within it that you begin to question it, right? It's like, you're here for the story, you're here to understand the Shire and the Hobbits and Gandalf and Sauron and Saruman. Like, there's so many other more important things happening, and it's so well written that I think, you know, we go for very long stretches of time where you don't even consider, mm-hmm. like, oh, hey, I haven't seen a CGI thing for a while. Like, that's great. It's great that I have not seen a CGI thing for a while, and that the story is well written enough that it can stand alone without that stuff.
Yeah, I was struck by the very same thing rewatching this, because I think, you know, the two subsequent films, and I say this again having not revisited them recently, but at least my memory of them is that they are a lot more battle centric than this first one. And, you know, you as you say, we do have the sort of opening narration background bit that gives us some CGI battle action, but then it steps back to that first shot of the Shire, and I cried. so did my husband, that transition is so, it's just powerful, like on a filmmaking level, and it does like give you that feeling of you're starting a storybook. You know, there was a prologue, and now we're actually getting into the story, and we're actually meeting characters and going to places. And, you know, this is a narrative. It's not just like right into the smashy. And again, having not revisited them, I would still venture to say that the next two movies are not as smashy as I remember them.
So, like, Genevieve, to your point of opening a storybook, I mean, obviously the cinematography is doing like exceptional things here. New Zealand, I feel like this was my first introduction to New Zealand, and I was like, oh, this exists? Like, yeah. Okay, this is tight. Like, this is amazing. But it's such an exceptional use of natural places, and you get such a strong sense of power from the production design and from building these locations, actually like investing money and time and finding them. And something else that was really exciting to me is the camera work is like, I rewatch this probably like every 6 months or so, but I always forget how many close-ups there are. Like, I don't know why, but so much of fantasy, I just expect like these wide shots, especially in Lord of the Rings, where we talk about how beautiful the locations are. But there's so many close-ups of like Gandalf and Bilbo and Gandalf and Frodo, and establishing who these characters are in that first like half hour to 45 minutes that gives us a strong sense of like, I understand what motivates this person and I understand what they fear. And all of that is really economically done in a movie that is still, what, like 3 hours? But tells so much story in 3 hours. I mean, I think that's what always astonishes me, especially as we talk about the TV show, is like, I love TV, obviously. But like, what Fellowship pulls off compared to like 3 episodes of TV is astonishing.
I also kept thinking about how well cast this film is. I mean, it's just kind of perfectly cast. And from Ian McKellen, just the right amount of you know, this weird mix of twinkle and menace that he brings to that. Christopher Lee, I can't picture anyone else but Saruman. But also like Wood and Astin, it's just such an inspired choices. Like Elijah Wood, you know, has done many other things and it is very good. But I mean, boy, was he born to play Hobbit. I mean, just those big expressive eyes, you know. But he's so, he's got range as an actor too. I mean, he's this endearing little guy, but it's also like just haunted. And you know, more and more as the series goes on as well. But you know, there's not really a bum note in the casting. Like, I don't think, I've never really been that into Orlando Bloom outside of this film, and I'm not sure some of the other cast members are probably, this is their best moment, but it is their best moment. I mean, I think they are just, you know, slot it very well into these roles.
You're not going to mention Viggo Mortensen?
Yeah, of course.
We'll give Roxana the honor.
What is there to say about Viggo? I mean, well, actually, I was talking to my partner about this, and I said that the three performances that stand out most to me upon rewatch are obviously Elijah, who brings like such a sense of innocence and determination that then curdles into something else. And, like, Ian McKellen's line deliveries are all really exciting. I mean, obviously, people quote "You Shall Not Pass" because it's perfect and iconic, but all the other stuff, like all of his conversations with Bilbo, and like, to Keith's point of this sense of menace and like exhaustion once he realizes what's happening. But like, what's so interesting to me about Viggo's performance is what he doesn't do. It's very constrained in an interesting way when he's being Aragorn and being like weighed down by the weight of responsibility. And then to have that contrast with how he sells the physicality of this performance.
Like, such a good fighter.
It's such a good like contrast. And I know that he replaced Stuart Townsend, right? Which, like, kudos. I'm sorry, Stuart. But like, that was the right call. But like, again, Viggo has been amazing in many things. Like, Eastern Promises is probably still my favorite Viggo. But in terms of like someone who could lead me into battle, like, good job. They nailed that 100%.
Obviously, Nicolas Cage would have been better casting. No, I actually don't.
Oh, yes,
don't,
of course.
I actually don't agree with that. You know, as I say that as a fan, but I can't really imagine anyone but Viggo Mortensen playing this role.
Mm-mm.
I mean, while we're talking about iconic performances, I do want to broach one that we get very little of here, but is central to this movie franchise, which is Andy Serkis's Gollum, and also very central to this film's sort of legacy when it comes to CGI effects. And the whole motion capture thing. Maybe we'll get into sort of like the, you know, how dividing this into three movies works, but Gollum's introduction and just like the taste we get of him here feels really, really smartly done in light of what comes next. Like, if you had come screaming out of the gate with too much Gollum, like, I think it would have consumed the movie. And it's an admirable show of restraint that they didn't show off that toy too much right out of the gate.
And that he's introduced with first a sense of disgust, and then what we're left with is a sense of pity, right? Because if we're treating Gandalf like the leader of the Fellowship morally and ethically and in terms of like what he's seen and what he knows can happen, I think often about Frodo being like, Bilbo should have killed him. And, you know, Gandalf's very sort of not wary, but just his sense of, well, you can't say that. Like, who are you to make that choice? I mean, so much of Tolkien, right, is about like personal choice and free will and like whether you really have agency in destiny and fate. But I think, you know, not showing us Gollum and then also saying, well, maybe you should not judge him before you understand what he went through was so smart. So smart. Just one of many intelligent character introduction things that this movie does. But Genevieve, when you started talking, I thought you were going to talk about Cate Blanchett.
Oh.
I feel like she has such an outsized like effect on these movies, despite being in them for what, maybe like 10 minutes, 15 minutes total?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Like, and maybe this is just like a me thing, or like when it hit me in my life and like what I knew of Cate Blanchett at that point, which was like not that much.
Nothing. Same for me. Yeah.
So obviously, like, the scene where, you know, she turns into Dark Galadriel is like emblazoned in my memory, but like beyond that, she is like far from the top of the list of associations I have with this movie. Am I an outlier there, Scott and Keith, or
no? I mean, but I do think she's really great in the moments that she that she does have, and that's one of them. But also just sort of like the moment when she starts speaking to Frodo in her mind, like, you forget because she's lovely and ethereal and powerful, but you also get, she's really scary. I mean, she's a really scary character, and like, you can see her taking the ring. I mean, you can see the temptation, you can see the impulse is real. It's not just like some sort of theoretical inner monologue that she's having. This is someone who's on the verge of taking that ring.
We're not going to talk about Hugo Weaving as well. As being
I was going to say, we're just like going to go down the list one at a time. Be like, we're not going to talk about this.
And I also think like, yeah, I'm not going to tip my hand too much, but like, casting is important in terms of.
Oh, Scott.
You know, I mean, like, these are magnetic performers. You know, these are perfectly cast actors. Every single one is really thought through. You know, you watch the film and you really, it's one of those films where you think, I wouldn't want to see anyone else in that role except for Galadriel, who's good in the new thing, but I'll get to that later. So yeah, I don't know, but I mean, to go back to kind of rewind quite a lot, I mean, I think there's just a sense of confidence here in the material on Jackson's part. It's just, rather than think like I'm making this big movie, I have to have an action beat here. I can't let things go for too long, but without kind of rattling people's cages a little bit. I think his thought was like, these books are pretty popular for a reason. And if I just have the faith that this world and that these characters are going to connect with movie audiences the same way that they have in books for as long as they have, then we're golden. And that's kind of what that feels like. I mean, you know, the thing I kind of like about it in terms of like the effects in the beginning is like, you're the first effects you really get beyond that prologue are just those like whimsical fireworks, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just such a, and that's like a, that's a character moment, you know, and it's a deployment of effects that's kind of wondrous, but also unusual. And, you know, and so tied to the spirit of the Shire, and so tied to, you know, Gandalf's, you know, warmth toward the inhabitants of that place. And, you know, it's, you know, so the effects that are there do work. But again, as we've said, just having the patience to know that this is a long story, to know that people are going to be on board because they're on board with the books, and then just and just go for it, and really kind of separate the movie too into, and this happens with the sequels, really have kind of discrete sections. You know, I mean, you really start to think of these, of all three movies, as having just, oh, this is the Mines of Moria, you know, bit. This is a part, and it's all going to be so vividly realized, and it's going to look different than everything else, and you're going to get there, and it's just, and it brings Scott Tobias back to his room as a kid, you know, looking at the map again, you know, just like, ah, here we are in this completely different place. And the film has that same kind of magic to it,
and I've always loved that we actually see the map. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that sort of like incorporation of what the book looks like and helping ground us and where we are. And I feel like, again, this goes back to Genevieve's point of like it being a storybook, like those are distinct chapters, right? It's like the Shire is a chapter, the Prancing Pony is a chapter, the first time in Rivendell. So like, as you're moving through these locations and each of them are so distinctly realized and so different, you are sort of getting that sense of movement along with these characters that feels physical and tangible and real. And I mean, subtweeting Marvel is fine, because I feel like we talk about how those movies lack texture all the time, right? So when you're actually dealing with these locations and sort of these places and the sense that people are actively moving within them, I mean, the movie, that gives the movie power.
Are you telling me this would not be as effective if it was filmed in a parking lot in Atlanta?
I would say that that would not be as good. Yes. But I mean, and you know, like, obviously we can say this about Marvel, but there have been like tons of, I mean, Ready Player One, like I was thinking about that as I was watching this movie. I mean, sort of all of these like gigantic, like, let's bring all of pop culture together. I mean, this movie has no interest in acknowledging other movies. And I respect that. I mean, like, so much of the humor, like, as everyone has said, is not this sense of like, oh, I'm like writing a joke in here that someone will recognize because it references something else. I mean, the humor is just that the hobbits are adorable and hungry all the time. And who has not related to that?
Earlier, Roxana, when you were talking about like all the close-ups and how effective they are, I was thinking how that is like very much linked to the film's practical effects, because so much of that is between characters of very different sizes, you know, and this film manages that very well through a variety of mostly practical filmmaking. I don't even want to call them effects, because a lot of it is just stand-in, so techniques, I guess. And the close-ups are a part of that. You know, if you're focusing in on one person, you don't have to focus on the differently sized person, you know, sharing a frame with them. But it's effective, like, on a character level, the same way that, you know, these real locations, these real New Zealand locations that aren't CGI or very maybe minimally CGI manipulated, like, they bring that added layer of pleasure to this, you know, and make this place feel real and exciting to be in. So while acknowledging that the, you know, computer effects in these films are revolutionary and well done and not overboard, the commitment to practical effects, I think, really pays off on a, I guess, story level or a narrative level and character level.
And some of like the shots that stick out most in my mind are the ones that play with that sense of like size and scale. Like, of course, the hobbits.
Frodo throwing himself. Oh, I was going to say Frodo throwing himself at Gandalf, like right at the very beginning.
One of my favorite. That's a great one. Yeah, like that one's wonderful. I mean, Gandalf in Bilbo's house when he's like frightening Bilbo to get him to release the ring, and like he summons darkness and like makes himself seem larger. That's a great one. Or like the hobbits hiding from the Nazgul under like the tree root. Mm-hmm. And then I have always loved the insects like being afraid of the Nazgul. These like gigantic spiders and centipedes like fleeing. So just like so much of that is just accomplished through extremely thoughtful composition and framing, and like these moments that just stick out to me. I'm also always surprised by how much dialogue I remember, but it's so well written and so naturalistic in a certain way that it just sticks in my brain.
With regard to effects, I think we here on the Next Picture Show, I mean, we just talked about The Thief of Baghdad not long ago. We have we have a certain amount of affection for older effects in movies, so effects that were that involved a lot of imagination. You might be able to sort of see the strings a bit, but what they have, of course, is that, you know, handmade quality. You know, the thumbprints of their creators are evident in a way that's kind of tactile and imaginative, and you kind of appreciate it on that scale. And you know, that's something that we don't think is possible with digital, like, you know, because it can be perfected. You can create entire worlds digitally, and they can be these cold sort of computerized images. But I feel like that's the thing with this movie. It just has like that continuity between those two types of effects. It comes from a certain, a level of expression, of a personal touch, you know, insofar as digital effects can have, you know, a thumbprint, it can feel, you know, expressive and auteurist or whatever, directorial, like this has that in a way that so few films do.
I don't know if we want to make any kind of generalizations about the era, but this was the fifth highest grossing film in 2001. And of those five films, One is the other. The, number one is Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Number two is Shrek. It's a season of fantasy. Like what were we so hungry for fantasy for? I mean, obviously 2001, 9/11, but I think you know this feels like
this was after that. This was post 9/11. Yes,
this right. One. But this is all you conceived before, and it's all like I wouldn't make or draw a direct connection there. Like you know, we all want to escape into fantasy, but there's something you know. It seems like you know there was a current there. We wanted magic and wizards and whatnot.
I mean, I would say that it was 9/11.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. All right. It felt like too easy, but yeah, go for it.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that it was that. I mean, this was like a holiday movie, right? I mean, I think mm-hmm. there was a certain sense back then. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. It was sort of long ago. Regardless, whatever. I think that there was like a desire for some sort of unity and escapism. And those are, of course, I think the easy answers. But I also think that this was a time when, like, and I say this with as much affection as I can muster, I feel like nerd culture was not the monoculture yet. So I think that there was still this sort of interest from fans of the book to see this movie and to see could what Peter Jackson imagined sync up with what they had imagined. And it had been a long time since someone had like taken a stab at this material, right? So I think that there was just an overall interest from fans who wanted to see what it could be like, and just a general desire from some sort of populist escapism because of what the country was going through at the time. Maybe both of those are easy answers, but I think, you know, we weren't where we are now. Like a decade into superhero dominance where like these things come out every 2 or 3 months and there's not as much sustained interest anymore. It feels like there was some other different kind of collective appeal happening back then.
There's more novelty to these kind of things. And also I think it was a moment of tech, you know, I kind of suggested this before, but it's like a moment when technology kind of caught up with the possibilities of the technology kind of opened up, you know, the type of stories you could tell. I mean, Harry Potter, I mean, say what you will about that first movie, it definitely has some downsides to it, but you know, it is also not as well, I would say, but it does mix practical and digital effects. I think the series got better at that as it went along. And it's also, you know, another faithful adaptation that kind of, you know, very great production design really kind of creates this world in a way that is the world of the page, but also brings some the designer's eye to it. So, you know, I think and it's only possible because the technology was there to make that movie at the time. This is a better movie, but I think some of the same kind of currents in movie making carry both along.
And I mean, I'm a little reluctant to say this, but since you brought Harry Potter up, like I think we can't really overlook the role that Harry Potter's popularity may have played in bringing a new generation to these stories. And you know, it's just the knowledge that, you know, these books are a precursor to Harry Potter, and they're not like that similar, but there's certainly some common elements, you know. And I feel like if you are a young person and Harry Potter is sort of your entry into fantasy, and it's this massive cultural thing, and then there's this other thing that you know is part of the path that led us to Harry Potter, and it's like, okay, yeah, why wouldn't I check that out? You know, I think it maybe, like, I think Harry Potter maybe like opened up some people to the fantasy genre, and these films just like hit at the exact right time to take advantage of that openness.
It opened the same year, both opened the same year I moved to Chicago. And in the sort of pre-smartphone era, I feel like there were just sort of phases of books everyone was reading on the train on my way to work. And this is very much the, if the person next to me wasn't reading Harry Potter, they were reading Lord of the Rings. It was, I think the final phase before smartphones totally took over was the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo era. I kind of missed that. I kind of missed that being a way to gauge what's being read as, you know.
I feel like it was 50 Shades.
Maybe.
Cause I remember commuting at the time and there would be numerous people on the bus reading it. And I'd be like, in public?
Yeah.
That's what I was saying. Like, people, like, they're showing the cover. They're like letting people look at the cover.
It made me scandalized every time.
this film, like the book, is divided into three sections. It's almost two. I mean, there's this movie could have been so many different permutations. I think Miramax really wanted like a one film version of Lord of the Rings.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And at one point there's going to be a two film version and then a two film, a Hobbit, and then two films of Lord of the Rings. I think it worked out. I think breaking it into the three books as they were published really works. But I was wondering, does this film work as a film on its own, or is it, you know, is it really ultimately like the book? Is it one big film?
I mean, it's one big film.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's effective. Like, I don't feel diminished when I end it, but it ends on like the introduction of the next phase of each journey. You know what I mean? So I have watched all three of them together enough times to know, like, oh no, it's 14 hours.
Wait, enough times? Like more than once you watched all three of them?
Oh, there's a reason we asked Roxanna to come on this episode, you guys.
All three extended editions in one day is just like the best thing that you could do with your time. But yeah, I mean, I think it works for this. I don't think it worked for The Hobbit. Like, I think maybe it gave Peter Jackson unnecessary confidence to think that The Hobbit could be three movies. But yeah, I definitely see the trilogy as like one contained unit. Each film within it is effective, but they require each other.
Absolutely agree. I would say, though, it is satisfying where you're left here, the moment that you're left with, because it really gives you this wonderful moment between Frodo and Samwise.
He's calm Sam. His friends call him Sam.
Okay. It gives you this wonderful moment with Frodo and Sam that kind of, you know, gets you prepared, you know, gives you this kind of raises the stakes emotionally, takes you to a new place. You know, you're kind of entering into a new part of this world. You're getting your first view of Mordor, and you're just anticipating what's to come. And that's the best you can do. I mean, I'm, you know, if the choice is between doing that or trying to condense all of that material into one movie, I mean, the choice is pretty obvious. I'd much rather have a part one that's going to be resolved, you know, where everything's going to be resolved over the course of 9 hours rather than squeezed into three. So it certainly works well for me.
It's interesting to me to hear you call it satisfying, though, Scott, because like, while I agree it works, like Fellowship ends on a down note. You know, it's our band of fellows has broken up, you know, and Boromir died. We didn't even talk about Boromir or Sean.
I'm sorry, Sean. I apologize.
Well, I guess it's a down note, but think about the best Star Wars movie, probably.
Exactly.
Empire Strikes Back ends on a down note, too. So
this
it's like
kind of the first Star Wars and Empire rolled into one.
But also, you do have like Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas, like being like, let's go hunt some orc.
Yeah.
You know, like you do still have like a kick ass sort of moment. Mm-hmm. And you know, Boromir like died doing what he loved, which was like sort of being a jackass and kicking ass, so he's fine.
He died doing what he loved, terrorizing hobbits.
No, I mean,
I know.
Isn't the best thing about Boromir that like he genuinely cares for Merry and Pippin, and like he does apologize to Frodo. Genevieve, I wish you hadn't brought it up. Now I'm sad.
Well, that's an appropriate note to end this on. One last
shout out is Howard Shore, because like Howard Shore is like, I knew it was like the guy who did like this really like unusual, like emotional but emotionally opaque scores for David Cronenberg movies, and here he is in just full like heroic mode and just kills it. Kills
the score's unreal. Like this, it's so important to the movie. Like when you have a score that's this memorable and this gives you different so many important beats too. I mean, the main theme has got so much kind of emotion and sweep to it, but then you know he'll hit you with some good sort of action music, and it is an incredible score.
The chanting and the drums in Khazad Dûm is exceptional.
Well, we could go so on much, talking about drums and chanting and music and all the performances we didn't even mention. Like Ian Holm. Ian Holm's so good. Guys, let's talk about Ian Holm for 20 minutes. Go.
Wait. Gandalf died, guys. Do we don't want to talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, Genevieve. I know. You know, come on.
Wait, I just want to know real quick. Did anyone at the time not know that
I didn't.
You didn't?
Oh, wow.
Okay.
No, because, like, I had seen Bakshi, but it was, like, fourth grade. Like, I had no, like, real memory of it after watching it. So I do remember harassing my brother and being like, what happened? and he refused to tell me. So good for him. He let me experience it for myself. Good for him.
Well, on that note, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this discussion about Roxana's brother and spoilers.
He's a good guy.
And all this stuff. And anything else in the world of film, not even Hobbit related, email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. If you want to share any responses with us and other listeners, or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. We'll be back in a minute with some feedback we've already received.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Now it's time for feedback. We're still sorting through a lot of feedback we got for Nope, a movie that raises more questions than answers, but it's fun to think about. Let's tackle a couple of them. Genevieve, can you share the first one?
Sure. Bennett writes, I was interested in hearing your different feelings on the scene with Gordy as either an interesting, thematically rich exploration or as a distracting intellectual exercise that does not serve the story at all. I personally really enjoyed talking about the scene with my friends after the movie, as we tried connecting the dots with different theories, but I fully understand why a primarily thematic detour didn't work for Tasha and Genevieve. After listening to your discussion, I tried thinking of some other examples of this happening in other movies, and I thought of the Mike Yanagita character in Fargo and the Golden Watch monologue in Pulp Fiction. I'm curious if you feel the same way about these diversions, or if there are distinguishing factors that make those work more for you. I mean, I think a distinguishing factor for both of those is that they are single scene things, and the Gordy stuff in Nope is really weaved throughout it in a way that, in my opinion, makes you think it is going to pay off in a way that it never does. But I already kind of said my piece on that, so I will open the floor to others to answer Bennett's question.
I don't know if I can answer it. It's been, I haven't seen Nope in a really long time, and there's a lot of stuff going on in that movie. All I can say is I liked it and wanted to think about it more. I mean, Nope is a movie that I think needs more than one viewing. It is a film that is full of stuff. That has been something that's been happening with Peele's movies. Each one I think has been more dense, has been more difficult to unpack, has been more filled with eccentric little pieces and challenges, I guess, to have you put those pieces together. And so I like the exercise that Bennett describes in his letter of getting together with friends and floating different theories. I mean, you know, without getting, again, without being able to say definitively what I think in terms of how the Gordy stuff really fits into everything else, I like the exercise, and I like a movie. I like movies that prompt to think through odd elements like that, because something like the Mike Yanagita scene in Fargo. I mean, that's a standalone scene. And when you see it the first time, it does stand out as being the one scene that isn't necessarily driving the plot forward, because it is a very strong, muscular pulp narrative that has this scene that stands out in a very deliberate way. But you watch that movie multiple times as I have, and then you really start to see, hey, wait a minute, there's something in Marge's decision making that is affected by that encounter with Mike Yanagita. There's something in Marge's desires as a married person, as a woman, of someone, the way that she approaches that moment too. All that comes with time, and so I guess my thought is that I feel like it fits. I just can't say why.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as the person who was probably least enamored with that element of Nope when we discussed it, I will readily acknowledge that I would probably appreciate it more on a second viewing, and just discussions I've heard about it since that viewing. We recorded that like less than 24 hours after I saw it. So those were still like very fresh reactions. And some of the theories or explanations I've heard about the Gordy stuff since then have been like, oh yeah, like that's really cool. And it's not that like I don't want that kind of element in my movie. My issue at the time was how hard I perceived the film to be hammering on this thing that it didn't pay off at the time, and I found it very distracting, and it took me out of sort of the rhythm of the film to kind of make me do that exercise of what does this mean? What's the connection here? And I found it distracting. Revisiting it, you know, knowing the full lay of the landscape of the film, I would probably find it more enticing in that respect. But, you know, on a first viewing, I made it clear it didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And I still don't believe the shoe landed that way just on accident.
Oh, that was so cool.
The shoe is the best part, Genevieve.
You wrote about the shoe, didn't you, Roxanne?
Yes, I love the shoe. I love the shoe. I think it's great. I mean, the other thing, too, is that my understanding is that the Gordy stuff was way more built out and they cut down a lot of it because there was a lot of stuff in the trailers that connects to the Gordy storyline that did not make it into the final cut.
Oh, really? I'll check that out again.
Yeah, so like I wonder if we ever do get a director's cut, because I think the stuff with Gordy, there's some element of like the show having a stalker and there being someone who like visits the set when the tragedy happens and is actually the person who kills Gordy. So I think there's like also sort of like an obsession subplot to that subplot that we did not get that maybe would have better contextualized Jupe's reaction to the Gordy stuff and put it sort of in a different frame to connect with the main storyline.
We've got another Nope question. It's an elusive film that opens itself up to a lot of different readings, as we've kind of proving now. Scott, you've got a letter focusing on one element of the film. Can you read that one for me?
Sure. Corin writes, "Was I looking too hard for racial commentary in every aspect of Nope? Maybe, but I've been sincerely surprised not to see any reviews I've read mention the significance of a black man having to lower his gaze to avoid violent attack. Each time I saw Daniel Kaluuya adopt this more submissive demeanor, I felt a little sick inside, perhaps more so because just before Nope, I'd seen a trailer for Till, in which Emmett Till's mother warns the doomed young man to quote-unquote make himself small. I also think it's worth noting that the movie's very premise is that no one will believe a horror has occurred unless someone produces unimpeachable video evidence. I love Nope on multiple levels, but seeing it as a metaphor for America's horrifying history of racial violence definitely contributed to how thoroughly shook I felt walking out of the theater. I'm sure y'all will let me know if I'm just being an overly zealous, liberal, try-hard white lady. Love the show." That's a really good letter, and I really love this second part of it, this idea of no one will believe a horror has occurred unless someone produces unimpeachable video evidence. That is not something I thought about, which seems like a really, really great insight into the movie.
Yeah, same. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. You have something better to say than I do. Go ahead.
No, I doubt that. All I was going to say is that, yeah, I mean, I think that like just the obsessive quest for, I mean, obsession comes up like every time I talk about this movie, so forgive me for being repetitive. But I feel like the Oprah shot is that, right? It's the sense of like this one perfect thing that will convince everyone that what you saw was real. And I think that it serves a good counter with what the movie is saying about like cinema overall being this made-up place where we find truth. So I think it's tackling both aspects of like what convinces you and why does it convince you and how can you suspend disbelief for one medium but not the other. And I will say, I think that Robert Daniels and Soraya Nadia McDonald, I thought that they did write about the first part of that question. I could be wrong. But I think there was some discussion of OJ's reaction to the alien and how that had different layers of meaning.
Could be. It's a lot of writing going on around this film, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, give us something to chew on. I mean, it's like, that was like, Nope was like something to like dig into. There wasn't a whole lot. Well, just there wasn't a whole lot of movies to watch this summer, but let alone, you know, a movie that was going to kind of have a lot of stuff and maybe not all fit together like it's supposed to, but there's something being attempted and something worth exploring and theorizing about, which is a very positive thing.
Well, speaking of theories, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and theories and their recommendations and all kinds of other things. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll go back to Middle Earth and back in time to its second age. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, if you adopt a pseudonym to hide out from black writers, make sure your dopey friends stick to the script.
Yo, Frodo, what you doing wearing the ring? All-powerful jewelry, is that your new thing? I know it's hard when you're little more than 3'4", your little ass so close to the floor. Trying to lead the fellows to the gates of Mordor.
The fellowship.
Yeah, the fellowship.
But don't rap about bitches and hoes. I rap about witches and trolls. Cause I'm passing on the words of the Elven King who wisdom to all. Frodo, don't wear the ring.
Frodo, don't wear the ring.
The magical link bling.
You'll never be the Lord of the Ring.